WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. In 1981, my guest, Father Thomas Keating, retired from St. Joseph's Abbey in Spencer, Massachusetts, where he was the abbot. He moved to an abbey in Snowmass, Colorado, looking forward to a quiet life during his later years. But just as he retired, he began getting calls from all over the country to conduct workshops in a technique of centering prayer he developed after studying with a Zen Buddhist master. Father Thomas's idea was to bring the contemplative tradition of the monastery to people who lead active lives in the world. There was such a demand for Father Thomas to teach centering prayer that a whole movement sprang up called contemplative outreach. Father Thomas is now booked a year in advance. He conducts workshops, produces videotapes, and has written many books. We're happy to have him joining us today on the phone from his monastery in Colorado because in 2 weeks he'll go into a period of solitude and silence for 5 months. But before he stops talking, I asked him to define contemplative prayer for us.
Maybe I could define contemplative prayer as the development of one's relationship with Christ to the point of communing beyond words, thoughts, and feelings.
So are you talking then about literally sitting in a quiet room, shutting out all the sounds of the outside world, in a sense, meditating? Is that what we're talking about?
Yes. In the Christian tradition, this is called discursive meditation, where one reflects on the good things of Scripture and makes them one's own. It's the opposite of speed reading, where one sort of absorbs the text and relates it to one's own daily life, and thus one gradually assimilates the teaching of Jesus and the other scriptures, and begins to enter what you might call a getting acquainted period, like you would in any human relationship. In other words, you have frequent interviews, or you have a heavy date with someone you want to get acquainted with, and as you keep this up, your acquaintanceship moves into might be called friendliness. You know, at first you feel, you know, you have to have your hair a certain way and you have to have a bow tie on and you have to make a good impression on the other person. But after you get better acquainted and have searched one's history and what you like and don't like, then you can put your foot up on the table and smoke a cigar and not be afraid that it would spoil the relationship. And so it's the frequency or the regularity of having an interview, so to speak, with God, that is the basis of getting acquainted. And as this friendliness develops, it invites us into a commitment that there's a friendship.
When talking about contemplative prayer, I'm curious whether movement has borrowed from Eastern religions, from transcendental meditation, and the kinds of religious quests that seem to focus very much on meditation, on mantras, on words that get you to a physiological, psychological, and maybe, if you're lucky, a kind of a spiritual state.
Well, these practices are certainly have great value, but they're not the source of Christian contemplation, which is rooted in the personal love of Christ and this growing relationship. Prayer might be defined as relationship, and a relationship, if it's alive, tends to grow and to deepen and to become more and more spontaneous and more enveloping of one's whole life and motivation. So centering prayer is not a technique in the sense of reaching a certain state consciousness, however valuable that might be, but it's rather of reaching a relationship of ever deepening love with the one whom we regard as the source of our being.
You've said that silence, and this is a quote, silence is the language that God speaks. And I would assume that someone who is just starting out and trying to read or understand that silence, that it must be very difficult to understand what you're looking for, because we're such a verbal culture. We put so much value in language and in words, and to put so much value in the absence of those things must be very difficult for someone to get used to.
Well, it is. It is a little difficult, although some people are quite prepared for it without realizing it and enter it quite easily and then are inspired by the Spirit to put in the foundational aspects of the relationship. In other words, what contemplative prayer does is frees us from an over-identification with the cultural conditioning of early childhood, because it moves us into an interior freedom where we can question some of the things that we absorbed unquestioningly at that very impressionable age. Most of us are more or less over-identified with our ordinary psychological awareness, that is, with events and people and our reactions to them, so that our mental life is dominated by what happens to us as if we were in a movie. And I over-identified with all the characters and forgot that we were in the theater. Well, through contemplative practice, which deliberately leaves that ordinary level of psychological awareness to cultivate the spiritual level of our being, we begin to gain a certain interior freedom, so that it's like being at a lousy movie where you know you can get up and leave at any time. So you begin to have the freedom to choose what you want to do, rather than to be pushed around emotionally by events or people or our emotional reactions to them.
Well, let me ask you another very secular question, though. What guarantee from contemplative prayer that when you enter this place that you will find God? How do you know that you just won't find yourself and all the stuff, you know, all that, whether it's psychological stuff or cultural stuff, or just all that, you won't just find yourself there instead of finding God?
Oh, that is an excellent question. And I think this might actually happen if you didn't enter it with the understanding and intention of faith. One needs to have an attitude of trust towards God, that if one is really seeking Him, as some of the early fathers of the Church said, He is seeking us even more. So that I venture to say, however, that even if one takes a few moments for quiet and enters into oneself, since God is at the center of ourselves, whether aware of it or not, that one might very easily find God even without intending to.
Father Thomas Keating joins us from an abbey in Snowmass, Colorado, to talk about the contemplative outreach movement. More after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Trappist monk Thomas Keating. I'd like to ask you some personal questions. You became a monk at the age of 20. I believe you were at Yale University at the time. What led you to seek the monastic life?
Well, it was at Yale when I was 18 to 20 that I became very interested, through studying some of the modern philosophies, in reviewing the basics of the Catholic faith in which I was raised. And so in reading Tolstoy and other writers, I had doubts, and I entered into a period of great struggle and introspection. And at a certain point, I discovered in the Yale library a set of books that were the commentaries on the four Gospels of Jesus, line by line, collected by St. Thomas Aquinas. And it was reading in that book that I grasped that the Christian religion is basically a contemplative religion, and that the contemplative dimension of the gospel is the essential part of the teaching. And that seed has continued to grow, you might say, all my life. I left Yale at the time the war began because I had some other commitments I'd promised to do.
And this was World War II.
World War II, and I actually graduated from Fordham University in 1943, and a week later I entered the monastery that I had discovered. And in those days, it was generally taught that the more difficult or ascetical life you chose, the more likely you were to become a contemplative. And since that's what I wanted, that's what I looked around for, and I think I succeeded. But I would no longer believe in that principle anymore, because my studies and my own experience have taught me that God is present to everybody and is calling everyone who is seeking him, or certainly the baptized persons, into the fullness of the divine life of love that circulates in the Trinity. And so I entered the monastery, and that strictness of life was very helpful in the beginning. We too have gone through many changes since the Second Vatican Council, and perhaps the life now is a little more balanced than it was at that time.
Well, I'm curious even what that early life was like in a monastery. Was it total silence?
Well, for beginners, it was pretty close to a total silence. You could speak to two people, a novice master and the abbot. But you couldn't speak to each other, and so it wasn't possible to make friends. You don't usually make friends with your superiors. Because they could always ask you to leave. So it was certainly a very silent life. And,
was it a lonely life?
Well, it was very exciting, actually, because we were learning about and studying the Gospels through the very rich Christian tradition of mysticism and so on. So there was I was cultivating the friendship of Christ much as I could, and that friendship was for those first few years all absorbing, you might say. Later we have modified the rule of silence considerably, so that friendship among the monks is now possible.
In those days
we got up at 2 o'clock in the morning, and we had a lot of vocal prayers all day long, and the work was hard, and we fasted a good deal, and so that the ascetical life or a penitential life was emphasized much more than the contemplative life.
Let me ask you about the effect of Vatican II on your work. Were you an abbot then in Spencer, Massachusetts during Vatican II?
Yes, I was.
How did that change your work and even life within that monastery?
Well, because we were asked to review our rules in the light of the gospel and the founders, and also of modern conditions, it brought about a very dramatic self-examination that was really quite traumatic for some in the monasteries, because it sort of questioned the value of a life which many of us had put our lives on the line to live. And so there was a lot of polarization in cloistered communities during those days, and this gradually subsided in some degree, at least. But it brought about more changes in our particular monastery's way of life and the order to which we belong in 5 years and in probably the previous 1,000 years. So it was the speed of the changes and the polarization of those who wanted to go slow and those who wanted to go fast, or not at all, that created a lot of tension in cloistered life then, which was very poignant, because everybody was so sincere and so convinced of what they thought was the right way to proceed that it was tough going.
I'm kind of stuck on this idea of being quiet, I guess, because it's so hard to even imagine what that is like. Did you find early on that silence was a burden, or that you had a thought and you just said, I must tell somebody about this, but of course not being able to?
Well, of course there are always those thoughts, but if you're sold out, as I was, on the process of deepening one's contemplative life, one has the value system to overcome all the difficulties and the motivation to keep going in spite of those kinds of contrary motivations. So I don't recommend that degree of quietness, but I recommend very much a certain degree of it that is appropriate to one's, you know, duties in life. All of us, I think, need periods of silence because there's a part of us, the spiritual part, that thrives on a certain peace of mind, and quiet, and external quiet tends to help to foster that. And that's why people go to retreat houses in such numbers. Our idea in contemplative outreach was to provide a very simple structure and instruction for lay folks so that they get the benefits of the monastic life without entering it. The centering prayer is really the kind of the quintessence of monastic prayer, which is to be in the presence of God all the time, whatever we're doing.
Well, I know you're a busy person, and Father Thomas, I thank you for joining us today on Fresh Air. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Father Thomas Keating is a leader in the contemplative outreach movement. In 2 weeks, he'll go into a 5-month period of solitude and silence. This is Fresh Air.